Blog Talk Radio.
See it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about what's happening in the world today. We talk about where we think the world is going, and we talk about the future, and we're not afraid to take a pretty contrarian view of those matters. We believe that if you're not excited about the future, you're not paying attention. We believe that something is going to happen, something wonderful. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you doing?
Man, I'm doing great. Had an interesting weekend with the kids and just had a great time. So,
well, it sounds like you were doing some traveling there. It looks like you've made your way back. I was also out last week, which accounted for our Monday night program last week. And now here we are on Monday again this week. So this is becoming
right.
An almost regular thing for us.
Yeah.
Just about ready to make this a weeknight show. I don't know, up against Monday night football, though. I don't know if that's a factor for us or not, really.
I'm thinking that Tuesday, that's going to be my vote if we do actually move to a weeknight. But
if we move to a weeknight, perhaps it'll be Tuesday. Okay, well, we'll check on that. Maybe we should check with our chat host, Michael Darling. Michael, you there?
I'm here, and if we could squeeze a weekday in between Monday and Tuesday, that would be my vote.
What do you mean, like?
Like?
I see. Yeah, between Monday and Tuesday. Well, we'll work on that. We got people that I think we can put to work on that. I thought for a minute there you were suggesting we do two shows a week.
Ooh. I wouldn't be opposed, but the second one should be on that weekday we invent between Tuesday and Wednesday.
Well, yeah, we do need that extra day in the week. Well, if anyone's going to help us come up with that, it would be our guest. I'm going to bring him out. Our guest this evening is scientist and author Jay Storrs Hall. Josh is the author of Beyond AI, Creating the Conscience of the Machine. This book deals with the possibly imminent development of strong AI and the desirability, if and when that happens, that such AIs be equipped with a moral sense and conscience. So we'll get into that a little bit. His previous book, Nanofuture, deals with what he describes as real nanotechnology. And for anyone who's unclear on what that would mean, that is actual molecular machines as opposed to nano stain protection on garments and that kind of thing. Josh was the founding chief scientist at Nanorex, which is developing a CAD system for nanomechanical engineering, and he's now a member of Nanorex's scientific advisory board as well as a research fellow at the Institute for Molecular Manufacturing. His research interests include molecular nanotechnology and the design of useful macroscopic machines using the capabilities of molecular manufacturing. He has a background in computer science, particularly parallel processor architectures, artificial intelligence, particularly agoric and genetic algorithms, as used in design and reversible computing. Josh is a proponent of replacing roads and internal combustion vehicles with flying cars, which he considers to be among the milder innovations that nanotechnology could not only make possible, but economical and safe. And another of those would be space travel. Finally, Josh is known as the originator of one of my all-time favorite ideas, utility fog, and I'm sure we're going to spend some time talking about that this evening. Jay Storrs Hall, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here. I think you'd better be careful about those extra days, though. There's this interesting science fiction story by Gordon Dixon in which the people in the story got taken in by some aliens who salted their week with fake Slunian time. Perhaps you remember that
fake Slunian time. Go ahead, Stephen.
I was just reminded of the Men in Black thing where, we're all on a different time, and you'll either adapt to it in a few weeks or you'll have a psychotic breakdown.
Well, I know which way I'm headed, but okay. So we'll be careful about adding extra time to the week. That's a timely warning. Thank you for that. Now, before we get into talking with you about some of these concepts that I mentioned in the introduction, we've got a new feature on the program that we're going to try out just tonight, and we're going to spring it on our guests. So this is really a little bit unfair, but the feature is called 2-to-1, Josh. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to read you three facts, what we would call astounding science facts. We have a regular feature on the program called Astounding Science Facts. We're going to read you three news stories, brief news snippets. Two of them are actual scientific developments. One of them is fake, and we want to see if you can sniff out the fake one. Are you game for that?
Oh, sure.
Okay, I guess
Stephen, you want to start?
Yeah, I'll start with the first one, and then we'll just kind of go back and forth until we're done.
Okay.
First one is, a sugar molecule has been detected 26,000 light years from Earth. It's an exciting find because this particular sugar is a key building block for life as we know it, and it's found in an area of the galaxy that should be favorable to life.
Okay, so that's amazing story number one, sugar molecule found in, where was it, another galaxy?
No, it's within this galaxy, 26,000 light years away.
Oh, okay. So a molecule found 26,000 light years away. Okay, well, that's, okay. Story number one. Okay, number two. I won't make any comments because I shouldn't. Okay, here's number two. A Russian professor at an Ohio university who has applied to patent a method for snuffing out hurricanes by flying jet fighters around the eye of the storm at supersonic speeds now asserts that he has developed a technique to reverse global warming by using a large fleet of supersonic aircraft flying against the jet stream.
Okay.
Okay, so that's number two.
All right, and number three. Nanotechnologists have theorized and simulated a nanoscale rotary motor that would be a million times faster than the biological motors that they are modeled after. It is hoped that these motors will one day power nanobots that could could live within us, keeping us healthy and young.
Okay, Josh, what do you think? That third one should be pretty easy for you, I would think.
I believe I remember that seeing that story myself. And I saw the story about the hurricane, but I never heard anything about the fellow claiming that he was going to cancel out the jet stream, which sounds quite a bit extreme. The first one sounds a bit more reasonable. So I would say that the cancel out global warming by using jets on the jet stream is the fake one.
You are absolutely right.
We need crowd cheering noises, I guess, that we should be able to play at this point.
We should have that going. Well, we should have known that we weren't going to be able to fake our guests out, and I'm glad we didn't. But you're absolutely right. The first half of that story about the Russian professor at the Ohio University is in fact true. He has applied for a patent and believes that he's got a way using sonic booms to shut down hurricanes. And I made up the rest as a kind of a science fiction extension of that same idea. So that was indeed the fake one. Stephen, what can you tell us a little more about that that molecule?
Yeah, they were able to detect this sugar molecule 26,000 light years away, apparently by the the pattern of light that they're getting off of it. And they have actually detected this before in a region of the galaxy that is not favorable to life. It was exciting. It was an exciting find for those, astronomers who are looking for, the building blocks of life elsewhere in the galaxy. It was an exciting find the first time, but now to find it in a region of the galaxy that should be favorable to life makes it even more exciting. So. That's a true story, but it's remarkable because, 26,000 light years away, that's not next door, is it?
That's a goodly distance. I wonder, though, when they say they found a molecule, does that actually mean one, or maybe there's a few out there, or what does that actually mean?
Apparently, it's like a cloud, like a nebula cloud or something that they're looking at, and of course it's bigger than the solar system is what we're talking about. This is huge. And it's apparently full of this particular sugar molecule.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And don't ask
me
to pronounce this sugar molecule. It looks a little like the word glycerin, but it's not that word. It's a little more complicated. But it's a building block of the RNA molecule, which, of course, is a basic builder of life.
Component of life.
Yeah, component of life.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Okay. Well, so there we've established two amazing science facts, one that was fake, and the fake one spotted by our guest. Very, very well done there, Josh. All right, let's get into talking about some of the subjects we wanted to talk about this evening. I wanted to start maybe to ask you a little bit about your book, Beyond AI. Could you tell us a little bit about the ideas that went into writing that book, and what are we talking about when we talk about creating the conscience of the machine?
Well, the book is really basically in three parts. The first one is just sort of to explain to people what AI is and why I think that it's going to actually happen. And then the second one is a little closer an idea of how it would work and how it might be alike and how it might be different from the way human minds work. And then the third is a bit more philosophical, especially ethics and moral philosophy, and gets down into the questions of what are they going to be like as far as their attitudes towards us and what are their motivations going to be and so forth. One of the reasons I wrote the book is that there seem to be two completely different views out there on the subject, and you might say there's a bimodal distribution. There are people who believe that these things are just going to take off and take over, and we're not going to have much to say about it. And then there are other people who believe that, you know, we're going to make them to do a certain kind of thing, and that's what they're going to do, and we don't have anything to worry about. And there just seems to be a big gap between these two, whereas normally you would expect a range of opinions to have a bell curve in the middle. And I looked at that and I thought, you know, something appears to be missing here. Why are people so wildly different on this? And especially if the ones who are, you know, thinking they're the robots are going to revolt and kill us all or have anything to say, then it's a subject that we ought to be worried about. I did a bunch of studying, and in fact, I've been studying AI since the 1970s. And it's true, nobody really up until the turn of the century really had been even thinking about ethics for the AIs, or whether or not once they got an AI that was intelligent, it would actually turn out to be a psychopath or something. You know, there are plenty of very intelligent psychopaths, and we don't understand the structures inside of their minds well enough to know what it is that makes them one or makes them not one. So that
one of the ideas
struck me
that,
as being really. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. I was
struck me as being something really important.
Sorry about that. I was just going to ask, one of the ideas that seemed to come across in the talk you gave at the Singularity Summit last year, the 07 Singularity Summit, you had done a kind of a reboot of Asimov's laws of robotics. You suggested some new laws of robotics. And in getting to those, you made an analogy to these altruistic vampire bats, which was really interesting, and it turns out that these vampire bats that engage in altruistic behavior have considerably bigger brains than the vampire bats who are selfish and who don't help out their fellow bats. Is there a case to be made that that an artificial intelligence, a self-improving artificial intelligence, will be by definition a morally superior being, or is that just wishful thinking to assume that will be the case?
Well, I don't think we should assume that it's the case or that it will be the case. On the other hand, it seems to be an open enough pathway. There's plenty of leeway to get you into that. You don't have to be perfect. if you build a machine reasonably smart and you teach it reasonably well, you get it started in the right direction, then it looks like it's a target big enough to hit. And once you do hit it, then the machine itself will be on your side and helping you out, and you'll be good. So the thing about the vampire bats and all the other cases in evolution where altruism and ethical-like behavior has evolved is to point out that there is, in fact, an evolutionarily stable strategy, a path for evolution to follow that it will stick to, that involves altruistic and ethical principles, and that in the proper situations and given the proper start, these properties can be more powerful evolutionarily than the ones that would go against them, the purely selfish behavior. And so we can hope that and one of the things that I wanted to point out was that the self-improving robots are going to be as smart about these things as we are. They're going to know everything that we know about self-improving robots. And therefore, if they know that we've put them in an evolutionarily stable path, they'll realize that their best bet, their best way to take advantage of what they already have, is to continue and improve that ethical basis that they have.
Josh, I worry. I think you're absolutely right that it's a target big enough to hit to have a friendly AGI. But what about the one time we miss and create a psychopathic AI? Is there a risk that we can't afford even one in the world?
I don't think that's right. And in fact, I think it's pretty clear that we're going to get some. But if you look at the human race, we have about 1% of psychopathic human beings. And yet, you know, they don't destroy us all. I mean, every so often they get out of hand and cause us a lot of grief, but they don't cause the rest of us to go completely down in flames. And the same thing ought to be true of the AIs, that if we build enough ethical AIs, they'll be able to police themselves and take care of the ones that that have been built without the proper consciences and so forth. But the key is that you have to build a lot of them, and you have to have a society of them, and they have to be able to do these things like police each other and keep watch over each other. Because once they get to the point of being really, really super intelligent, the only thing that's going to be able to police one super intelligent AI is another super intelligent AI.
What about the idea that an artificial general intelligence is operating at a speed so much greater than we're operating at, that it takes on a tremendous amount of power? It has leverage relative to us just by the speed at which it operates. Is the kind of nightmare scenario of the first AGI, if it comes out, you know, if the first one that's developed is not a morally upstanding being, if it's a psychopath or just maybe just not a very nice AI, is there the risk that it takes over and there's no opportunity then to build friendly ones, or do you don't see that sort of scenario as being realistic?
Well, that's sort of what's sometimes called the hard takeoff scenario, where there's some trick that somebody discovers that all of a sudden everything just works, I think that's just a really short-sighted telescoping of the kind of developmental process that's going to have to be gone through. I mean, we don't even have an AI right now that's the equivalent of a four-year-old as far as its general learning ability is concerned, and that's the thing that is also ultimately going to make the difference. So when we do actually get an AI working at all, it's going to be, you know, a one-year-old or a two-year-old or something like that. And it's unlikely to actually be any faster than a human learning that kind of stuff. It'll be able to learn in different ways, but we sort of imagine a computer being able to suck in all of Wikipedia or something like that in a few hours. But the fact is that the computers that we have that can suck in Wikipedia are not doing the sort of things that they have to do to actually learn it the way a person would. So they don't actually understand it. And
can't apply it to a new situation.
Yeah, we know what it takes to build understanding. We know how to write programs now that can drive cars and other sorts of things that humans do that we consider difficult and we consider to require intelligence. But the reason we consider them to require intelligence is that the person who learns to drive a car, for example, has actually built all those skills. He's done inside his own head what all of those programmers in the ARPA challenge have done. Okay, and that's a lot of mental work. And but because we can sit down with a bunch of programmers and actually write programs that do things like that, we know how much work that is. And so what we're trying to do is essentially to build a program that can do that much programming. And that's a hard job. I mean, even once we get the program that can do it, I mean, we know that our brains do that kind of thing, but we also know that our brains use something like 10 to the 16th operations per second equivalent, well above the biggest supercomputers at this point. And we think we can do it a little more efficiently, such that the big supercomputers now actually are the equivalent of a human brain. But they're just the equivalent of one human brain at this point. You're going to have to wait another decade or so of Moore's Law before you get computers that are sort of cheap enough to make a huge difference that are as powerful as a human brain. And so you simply aren't going to have a program that is going to be able to take off like that. Especially since the early programs of any kind are nowhere near the optimized versions that you get after you've been doing it for a few years. Now, once we've had AI going for a decade or something, the baby AIs that we build in the next few years are going to have learned enough and grown up till they are then going to be smarter than individual people. But they're still not going to be smarter than the human race as a whole or even a decent-sized company. You'll probably have to wait another decade after that before any individual AI is sort of the equivalent of the entire scientific community or something like that. Given that the scientific community and the business community and the legal community and so forth all have head starts and they're pretty good at protecting their prerogatives. I would think that it would take a few decades at least before the AIs were really pretty much completely in charge.
Okay, so that's an interesting way of framing the time scale, and you know what I like about it is you start with a few years down the road. You have this class of new, you know, this nursery school of new baby AIs. They're not quite human level intelligence, but you say within a decade or so after that, maybe you've got something operating at human level intelligence, and then maybe within a decade after that, you've got something operating at the level of intelligence of the entire scientific community. What's interesting to me about that is, based on the time scale I was giving, that seems really slow. But based on any rational projection of anything that's ever occurred in human history before, that would be unbelievably fast to go from not quite human intelligence to human intelligence to this superhuman intelligence. You're saying basically at a period of, what, 20 or 30 years, and then from there, maybe a decade or two more, to the point where we would truly be welcoming our robot overlords.
Or we join them in some way, perhaps.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of that going on as well. I mean, I would certainly hope that I got a few upgrades myself.
Exactly.
But you have to understand that if you want all this AI to make a serious difference in the world, and people do, and the people who are doing AI, one of the reasons that they're doing it is that they want it to make a difference and make a better world. You have a smarter machine.
Hello?
Hello, Josh?
Well, I see it seems we've lost him completely. I don't see him on the switchboard anymore, Phil.
Okay, Josh, if you can hear us, please call back in, and we'll wait for you to
I think this is him.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, call got dropped somehow.
Okay, we got you back. Great.
Okay.
We should have mentioned before you join that we have a weekly audio glitch. Every week something happens on the show, so congratulations, you're the big winner tonight. So.
Okay, great.
Sorry, go ahead.
But the point was that if you have a machine that can make better decisions, and that's the whole point of having a machine that's smarter, then it's not going to do you any good unless you actually let it make the decisions. And so essentially for our own good, at some point we're going to have to put the AIs in charge.
Well, and I think if we reach a point, let's think through this. If we reach a point where we can acknowledge that they're smarter and that following an evolutionary path that we can now see where the optimum behavior actually does tend in a more moral direction, these artificial intelligences are going to be more intelligent than us in all respects, including the moral dimension. It would be insane not to, wouldn't it? I mean, it would be crazy to, you know, have this potential ability to kind of set things right and then not use it. But the way I hear you describing it is us allowing the AIs to take control, not the AIs coming in and asserting control. Is that right?
I don't think it's going to be that simple one way or the other. I mean, one of the things that's probably going to happen is that you have companies that begin to be run by AIs. And, I mean, it doesn't even have to be anything legal. They'll just have these computers and the computers will say, I think you ought to do this. And the president of the company will always say, okay. And first thing you know, the humans that are nominally in charge are going to be like the Queen of England and, operating with the advice and consent and all this sort of stuff of the computer and be essentially figureheads. But the computers will be making the real decisions. And after that goes on a while, it becomes harder and harder for them not to do what the computers say. And the reason that this happening at companies is most likely to be one of the major developmental paths is that one company can get ahead in the marketplace simply by being better at whatever it's doing than another one. Whereas it's a lot harder for that to happen in the world of politics or whatever. So you would expect the innovation and that sort of thing to start taking place in the market. Once it became understood generally that your company was really incompetent unless it were run by an AI, then people would start saying, oh, you know, maybe we better put these in charge of some other stuff as well.
Well, and seeing where artificial intelligence has become an extremely important component in parts of the financial services sector, particularly online trading and those kinds of things are pretty much driven by this kind of arms race between who's got the better trading algorithms and who's able to who's able to make slightly more sophisticated analysis and who's able to make slightly quicker, accurate projections and predictions as to where the market is going. So to a certain extent, the artificial intelligence revolution in business is beginning to occur, kind of at the worker bee level right now. But eventually, you see that moving higher and higher up the management chain.
Yeah, although there can be an interesting sort of double exposure there, where in many cases, you have the machine. Just to pick a very simple example, you have the machine that knows the right chess move to make, but you still don't have a sophisticated robot enough to reach out, pick the piece up, and move it over. Because that was the case, for example, in the 60s, you had machines that could play chess, but the robotics wasn't there yet. And this can be the case in some of those financial things. There are certain levels that you think are higher levels that are actually simpler than the lower levels, and the machine can take those over first. On the other hand, a lot of the financial models that they've been using in the marketplace, especially the ones that the Federal Reserve was using, apparently had some serious problems with them, which is why we're sort of the mess that we're in. To some extent, that gets back to the point that I was talking about before, of the current AI is the system that can do such and such a thing, but the system itself is built stick by stick by people, rather than being a system that can build itself. And one of the nice things about cracking the key AI problem, the having these self-building systems, is that you might be able to get a system that didn't have some of the blindnesses that people bring to the task when they put these big models together, and get models that actually accorded a little more closely with the real world.
Wonderfully powerful to have something that can help see past our blind spots, although how we create systems that see past our blind spots to begin with, because we'd have to program around those, I would think. Let me just say that this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Jay Storrs Hall about artificial intelligence. Coming up on our second half, we're going to talk some nanotechnology with him. If you would like to join our conversation, we have a lively chat going on in the online chat if you're listening live, or leave comments at blog.skillist.com. Now, I see, speaking of the chat, that we've got a couple of questions, Josh. Let me run one of these past you. This came up in our chat room. Someone asks, if an entrepreneur was willing and ready, how would she commercialize nanotech or AI now in December of 2008? So we got somebody out there who wants to make a killing in one of these two fields. So what would you recommend?
I'm not sure exactly what you would do if you were to sit down and start trying to build something, but I can guess that in nanotech, the big things that you're going to see over the next few years are going to be electronics and sensors, chemical sensors and that sort of thing. Everybody talks about materials, but the thing is that if you're building enough material to make something, you're using quite a few more molecules than if you're making a sensor that can detect some kind of chemical presence or some new form of computer memory, for example, or something like that. And so I expect that near-term progress in nanotech is going to be in fields like that. In AI, there's all sorts of stuff going on. We have the self-driving cars, and the thing is that the kind of techniques that they use to build those are getting to be well understood enough that if you could think of a killer app that required that level of understanding and control and real-time reactivity and so forth in robotics and that sort of stuff. I expect that this coming decade is going to be considered a big decade for robotics for that reason. Okay.
A couple of weeks ago, we had Brad Templeton on the program. He was talking about his idea for saving the world with robot cars. And
right.
as I was reading your introduction, talking about NEDEC, which you on your webpage you talk about that as being a good healthy alternative to the internal combustion engine. What would the advantage be of flying cars over robot cars? Do you think if we had flying cars, would they be robot driven as well?
Oh yeah, they would have to be. We're actually reasonably good at driving ground cars because walking along on the ground and navigating is what our nervous systems are designed to do. And we're not actually all that good at flying. If you watch a human pilot, it's amazing that he or she can do what they can do. But you watch a bird who has a considerably smaller brain. It's just it happens to be designed for that particular application, so to speak. And the bird is just a much better flyer. And you could build similarly a brain for a flying car. And this is technology that's essentially there already. I mean, commercial airplanes have autopilots that are essentially capable of doing everything the human pilot does now. So one of the reasons that flying cars could be very safe would be that you wouldn't have people in control of them. But the other reason to have them is simply that you wouldn't have to pave the whole country over, and you would essentially have 10 times the reach. I mean, you could hop in the thing and move 10 times as fast from point A to point B, and that would have an enormous benefit as far as the economy was concerned. You'd have 10 times the choice, actually 100 times the choice, because you're moving over a square area that's 10 times as big on a side.
You can't cut out the fact that flying cars would just be wicked cool. Let's face it. I mean,
absolutely. Yeah. Well, you get right down to it. That's why I'm so in favor.
That's the real reason
for that.
Yeah.
Josh, you have seen a parallel between the history of AI and the history so far of the development of nanotech. Could you explain that for our audience?
Yeah, this is the thing I just sent out to the Foresight Institute readership, and the basic idea is that here you have these two developments that are sort of seen as visions, they get going and people start working on them, and then this funny change happens, the focus appears to shift from the visionary core of the field to the periphery, where people begin working on things like direct applications for whatever it is, whatever techniques that they managed to come up with at the time. And the key similarity is that the center focus, the thing that tends to get forgotten in these peripheral shifts, is the notion of having a system that can feed back on itself. In the case of AI, it's having a program that can learn and extend its own programming. And in the case of nanotechnology, it's the notion of having a nano factory or other atomically precise manufacturing system that's able to build the parts and do some of the assembly of other down the line nanofactories, and so that you close the loop in both cases. And it's closing a bigger box than a purely self-reproducing system, but it's a smaller box than an evolving system. Okay, it's sort of somewhere in between those two, in terms of you know, big general words that you describe lots of systems with. But that's the key. That is the system that gives you reinvestment of your capital, essentially. That's the system when you can build systems that have autogeny. The smaller the piece of the system where everything that goes into it comes out of it, the faster the time to double your money, essentially.
And if that system were, say, the size of a desktop printer, obviously you've got something
then,
powerful
then you're
there.
You're talking about something really, really amazing, right? Even if it were something the size of a building, you'd have something pretty amazing.
Technology and artificial intelligence. We started with these kind of autogenous, if that's the right word, visions for how these technologies would play out, and we thought of human level artificial intelligence, self-improving systems. And we thought about nanotechnology. You know, the assemblers that K.R. Drexler wrote about in Engines of Creation, that these fields started off with these autogenous visions, and then
is follow the money. I mean, when you have people who are trying to do basic research, which is what it takes to do the autogenous core, that's a much longer term investment than trying to do immediate applications. Once you've gotten enough work into the, like for example in AI, once you got up into the 70s, and you had programs like Shurdaloo, the talking that had been cracked up to be able to solve, and to some extent the same thing has happened to nanotechnology. You get all the techniques, the laboratory techniques for doing things with molecules, with scanning probes and generating nanotubes and all this sort of stuff that were sort of developed by scientists looking for the pathway to understanding exactly what was going on down there and to being ultimately able to build machines. And they say, look, we don't have to build manufacturing machines. We can just make the stuff that will do X for, you know, whatever X they could get funding for. And so they went off chasing the money, and indeed they get a lot of money. And in fact, they're building a lot of cool stuff. I mean, there's lots and lots of things I'd rather that I'd rather have the current nanotech or the current AI, for that matter, being done. Don't need the basic center research anymore. It took a while for it to be realized that there was still a lot more to be gotten out of that out of the center focus than was going to be directly achievable from the periphery, and so ultimately attention came back to the focus, and I think it's happened a little earlier in AI than in nanotech because it just started early.
Let's say things like fab labs that may be self-reproducing, that are not, they're something less than nanofactories, but still quite powerful for us.
Right. There's a phenomenon in autogenous systems that is called the substrate. And essentially the substrate is whatever it is that you're autogenous system needs as its inputs to be able to create copies of itself. And if the system is extremely sophisticated, like life, the substrate can be essentially dirt and sunshine. But if the system is like the rep wrap, the self-reproducing personal fab that we're talking about here, the substrate has to contain things, people with fabs that can start out with much cheaper stuff and still build an autogenous fab.
That's fascinating. And we've seen, in some ways, we've seen a similar parallel in just things like computers. The price of computation has dropped steadily, since computers were in computers.
And what we expect to happen over these next several decades, when we have the AIs, learning and getting smarter and beginning to take over and so forth, and then we have nanotechnology developing and nanofactories that sit on your desktop and whatnot, is that the and this is exactly the effect of the closing circle of making that the reinvestment loop tighter.
Artificial intelligence before we'll see true molecular manufacturing.
Yeah, and that's okay. Just a personal guesstimate, mind you, but I think it's a reasonably well informed one. So one of the enabling factors is clearly going to be new computers that are powerful enough to do the sort of stuff that I think the brain is doing, we can get around a lot of this computation by doing it more efficiently than the brain does, but there's a limit to that, and so we're not going to get it for free. We're going to have to put in some serious computing power. The brain is an amazing computer, and we're not going to get away with using a piece
from there.
Yeah, although I think that the way it has fallen out in practice is that the kind of computer that I could afford to put on my a desktop in about 5 years is going to be capable of being a human level AI, and so I think that just the way it actually happens to fall out, the next generation of processors from Intel, they're already beginning to demonstrate these 32 nanometer feature sizes. And they're well under 100 already. Most of the official definitions that only measure the sizes of things, your computer is nanotech.
Mm-hmm. Right. But then by that definition, my stain-resistant pants are also using nanotechnology, right? So we don't want to...
Right. But, they let them say that, so what can you do?
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, we're running short on time, so we've got to get right to the good stuff. So let's say artificial intelligence shows up in, 5 years, molecular manufacturing, maybe another 15 years after that. When do we get utility?
Going to be able to make things like the little motors. Remember, one of your three science questions was somebody inventing a nanomotor that had actually quite a lot in principle in common with the electric motor that Eric Drexler goes over in some detail in nanosystems. You might look that up and check out the similarities there. Atomically precise industrial base necessary to make that many little robots.
Josh, I wanted to share with you the bumper sticker I have. My other car is Utility Fog.
Oh, well, that's I wish mine was.
Yeah. I guess the point of the joke is if you have a car that's Utility Fog, it can be any car you want, so why do you have a why do you have a second car? So, at any rate.
The real trick being the programming. I love the idea of even in early days of utility fog. If you have a pile of these little robots and you can run the bicycle program and it's your bike, and then it starts to rain and you decide you want to walk and it becomes your overcoat program, right? And you say okay, coat now, right? And the bike becomes your coat, or it becomes whatever you need it to be. Love the idea of
within limits.
I guess you know there would have to be limits around how much of the stuff people would have. It seems to me that once you have utility fog, you've crossed that threshold of the Arthur C. Clarke sufficiently advanced technology being indistinguishable from magic. Once we have utility fog, we all live in kind of a magical world, don't you think?
Yes, there are many things that caused me when I was writing the original utility fog chapter for B.C. Crandall's book. I just kept thinking of that because every single thing looked like, oh wow, you know, this is magical or whatever. So you're right.
It's like the genie let out of the bottle, I think. Well, our time has run out, and it just went by much faster even than I thought it was going to. Josh, we thank you so much for being with us. We really enjoyed talking with you. We hope that we'll be able to have you on again in the near future.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So thank you very much.
All right, Stephen, what have we got going on music-wise this evening?
We're going to be played out tonight by a band called Nilo, and the song is Jumping Bean.
Okay, Jumping Bean by Nilo. Thanks, Stephen. Michael, thanks to you and all our friends in the chat room, everyone listening, and a special word of thanks again to our very special guest, Jay Storrs Hall. We look forward to being with you all again Sunday evening on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, good night.
Play, and I know where the shadows roll away, and I know where the spaces divide, and I go to the sunny place sometimes, something to realize, something to replace your time, and I know where the rain doesn't play, and I'll go where the shadows roll away. Within, and I guess that the running makes me thin, and I say that it's for you to take, and I say that it's all that I can make. It's something that the people say, something that will make you stay, and I know where the rain doesn't play, and I'll go where the shadows roll away. Your day.